All right, we are at the end of 1 Peter, chapter 5. And I think we left off about verse 6. So just to kind of get ourselves in the groove here, I'm going to just do a very quick summary of where we're at. So he's talked about, at the beginning of chapter 5, elders and the need for good elders to get them through their suffering that they're going through. And he talks about the roles of elders, and then he goes into the role or responsibility of the flock. And what is kind of the main thought in both of whether you're an elder who is also a Christian or it's the Christians who are under that authority, it is humility that is a must. And that's why he says here in verse 5, he says, clothe yourselves with humility, all of you, towards one another. And so that's really incumbent upon all of us, whether you are in the position of being an elder or whether you are the flock that is in submission to the elders. We are to be humble. And the idea of humble here is the idea of service. We are to serve each other. And the reason is because we are all under the authority of God. And so he's going to continue that train of thought here in verse 6. And he really is going into just generally what is required of us. Verse 6, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, so that at the proper time he may exalt you. So, a question. When he says to humble yourself under the mighty hand of God, what should that bring to mind, if you're familiar at all with the Old Testament? This phrase is used a lot in the Old Testament to talk about the mighty hand of God or the outstretched arm of the Lord. So where does this really first begin? Anybody remember? Anybody? All right, so let's think back to, you're exactly right, let's go think back to Exodus. Really, this statement is used in Deuteronomy 5 as well. But if you go back to the book of Exodus, what is the scenario that God's people are in that is similar to 1 Peter? Slavery, suffering, right? They're being persecuted by being enslaved to the Egyptians. And so God comes to Moses, as Adam said, and he tells him, I'm going to deliver you and my people, Israel, with my outstretched arm. And he's going to know, he's going to see the acts of what my arm can do, so to speak. And then Deuteronomy 5 is another example I mentioned where he talks about that. And that's really the idea that, and maybe Peter has this in mind, but God's people in the Old Testament, in Egypt, they were exiles, they were aliens, and they were suffering hardship. And so God delivered them with his outstretched arm. And from that time on, even the prophets are going to talk about that. Isaiah talks about this as well, that he delivers his people with an outstretched arm. And so I just point that out because it really continues the same thought as what Peter is talking about here. He's telling them, you're no different than God's people Israel. They were in slavery. They were exiles. They were suffering. God led them out. And there's no difference between their story and your story. He says, you need to humble yourself. And if you will humble yourself, and do that under the mighty hand of God, the hand of God who also led his people Israel out of Egypt, he will do the same for you. He will deliver you. And then at the proper time, he may exalt you. And this really goes back again to the teaching of Jesus, where he talks about the fact that if you will humble yourself, those who humble themselves will be exalted. And he's just continuing on the same preaching that Jesus started in the Gospels. Verse 7, casting all your anxieties on him because he cares for you. This is a sign of what? If you're casting your cares on God, what is this a sign of? What he's just talked about. All right, dependency. That is true. If you're casting your anxieties on God, you are showing that you have no power over this. God's the only one who can help you with it. Right. There's something else more specific though that he's just got done telling them to do. Humility. That's right. A sign of humility is when you are casting your cares on the Lord because you know you can't deal with the anxieties yourself. And that is a very major point of emphasis as a Christian, is we are not in control. We are in control as far as we choose the way we're going to be, the way we're going to act. But as far as the things that are happening to us, they're going to happen. And they're there to test us. They're there to strengthen us, to strengthen our faith, as he's talked about at the end of chapter 4. But a classic sign of humility is not trying to take care of the anxieties and the stressors in your life yourself. You let the Lord deal with it. And that's what Peter says. You know, if you are humble and if you're putting yourself under the mighty hand of God, it's going to show because you're going to give your burdens to the Lord. And he will take care of them. And then he says in verse 8, he says, be sober-minded, which he's talked about this some already back in chapter 1, in verse, I think it's verse 13, he's talked about this. Therefore, preparing your minds for action, being sober-minded, set your hope fully on the grace that will be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And he also does it in chapter 4 in verse 7. The end of all things is at hand. Therefore, be self-controlled and sober-minded for the sake of your prayer. So he's talked a little bit about this already, being sober-minded. The opposite, of course, of being drunk is being clear-minded, being able to think straight. And then he says, be watchful. The New American Standard says to be on the alert. So here's another question for you. Why might Peter, of all people, tell these readers to be on the alert and to be watchful? All right, very good. Yeah, Pat said, this goes back to the idea in Gethsemane, right? Remember what happened in Gethsemane when Peter was there, some of the apostles, disciples were there, and what did Jesus tell them? Be watchful and pray and be on the alert. Why? That's right, because these temptations are going to come flooding in, and if you haven't been watchful and you're not praying, he's going to overtake you. That's right. So maybe Peter, when he says this, this has a special meaning to him because they weren't watchful and they weren't on the alert. They did not listen to the voice, to the command of Jesus there. And what happened to him? They failed. They fell into temptation. So maybe a little bit more meaning is this phrase, be on the alert or be watchful, in terms of Peter and his past. And the reason we're to be watchful, we've talked about this a little bit, but he's a little bit more specific here as to the temptations. He says, you or your adversary, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. And this is really the only time that Peter specifically talks about the devil in this book. And it's here. And he defines him or describes him in a scary way. This is he's prowling around. He's a roaring lion. Like you think about a lion that's hungry, hadn't eaten in a long time, and he is just waiting to get the first bite at somebody. And that's really what the devil is like. He's ready to take you off guard while you're off guard. And that's why it's important to be watchful. Also, keep in mind, how did Peter describe here in chapter 5 the Christians under the leadership of the elders in verse 2? That's right, they're a flock. So you have a hungry lion that's lurking around, and he sees the flock, he sees a lamb, he sees the sheep. You think he's hungry? Think he's ready to take a bite out of one of those lambs? And so Peter may be also showing us again the importance of the need for elders, that you have a being that's more powerful than you, and he is trying to take you alive. He's trying to eat you up. And we need good elders to look over us, to look over our souls. Now, that doesn't mean that the elders are the only one who can do this job. This is a responsibility of all of us. We all have the responsibility to be on the alert together, to look out for each other. And it just so happens that that is also something that the elders are to do. And this shouldn't come as a shock to us, right? I mean, Paul's talked about this in Ephesians chapter 6. The New Testament warns about the idea of what we're up against, these unseen spiritual forces that we are fighting against. And so we are in a struggle. And Peter's making that very clear. They're in a struggle, and they need help. They need to cast their anxieties, cast their burdens on God, and in that way, be watchful. And if we do that, it makes it a lot less easy for the devil to get hold of us. The third command is connected here with the second one. So he wants us to resist him. What does that imply? What's the implication of that? Okay, that we can. What's that imply about Satan? Okay, he's not all power. He can be defeated, right? So if we can resist, that means that as powerful as Satan might be, he can be defeated. And I think that's important. It's important for these readers to realize as well, considering what they're going through. Satan, yes, he's very powerful, and we cannot do it on our own, but he can be defeated. He's been defeated over and over again. He was defeated when Jesus was resurrected. And if that's the case, he can be defeated when he is on the prowl against us. So be watchful, resist him. And then he says, be firm in your faith. And he goes back to chapter 1 and verse 5, who by God's power are being guarded through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. And so our faith is the victory that overcomes the world, a song that we like to sing a lot. That is, our faith is what helps us be victorious if we have our faith in the Lord. We also aren't alone. He says, knowing that the same kinds of sufferings are being experienced by your brotherhood throughout the world. So they're not alone in this. Yes, they're being reviled. Yes, they're being slandered. But he makes it very clear that you can fight the good fight. You can fight the war. And also remember that there are others going through the same things that you're going through. And this brotherhood is who said to love back in chapter 2 in verse 17. Honor everyone, love the brotherhood. Fear God, honor the emperor. And so he says, you know what? None of us are alone in this. And we are all in this together. So resist and you will be rewarded. And after you have suffered a little while, and this, that's what he says next. That goes back to verse 6. We don't know what the proper time is, but we just know that there is going to be a relative to our suffering, relative to their suffering that they're going through, the reward is going to be great, right? So yes, they're suffering, and this is going to be for a little while, however long that is, but it doesn't match up to the reward that you're going to receive from God. And that should give them a lot of endurance. He says, the God of all grace, who has called you to his eternal glory in Christ. And that's why suffering is a little while. Compare that to being called eternally to his glory in Christ. And Christ is going to do four things because of that. What four things is he going to do? What's the first one? I hear a lot of whispering. Say that again. Restore. That's right. He's going to restore. He's going to perfect. It's the idea, if you go and you buy a home that needs to be remodeled, you buy it and then you just completely remodel it and flip it to where it's something that you can live in now. And you restore it to its proper condition. And that's what Peter has in mind here. He's restoring us. He's perfecting us. He's restoring us to our proper condition that we had all the way at the beginning before sin entered the world. All right, what's the second thing? Confirm. That's right. He's going to confirm us. He's going to strengthen us. And he's going to establish us. So if you look at this list, it says something about who we are. If we need to be restored and we need to be confirmed and strengthened and established, that must mean we're in a pretty pitiful place. And we are. We are all weak. We are all faltering. We are all struggling as Christians. In other words, we are working, striving, we're laboring in our service to the Lord. But Jesus has promised us that after a little while, there will come a day when he is going to renovate us. He's going to transform us completely and perfect us into what he wants us to be. And that's a really cool way for Peter to end this book on suffering. Is you hang in there, and before you know it, he's going to renovate and restore you in a way that you couldn't even imagine. As much as this suffering may bring you low, God is going to lift you high. And so, this verse 11 is what we call a doxology. It's a phrase of praise to God. He says, to him be the dominion forever and ever. Amen. Questions up to that point?
John, I think it's interesting that...
Wow, sorry.
Go ahead. Everything he said about the bad things that they're enduring at the hands of men, he never referred to masters or emperors or authorities as the enemy. The only one he never refers to as the enemy throughout the whole book is the devil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. He does, he does work through those people, but ultimately, if you trace those people to the root, it is the spiritual force that's behind that, that is what we're fighting against, and that's certainly the devil himself. And, you know, I think he makes that point at the end of chapter 3 when he's talking about those evil spirits. That's why it's important for us to realize the danger behind what they can do, but that God has subdued them. And so, and I think Paul makes that same point in Ephesians 6. We're not wrestling against flesh and blood. We're wrestling against powers and evil forces that we can't even imagine or see. And that's scary. But Peter, at the end of this book, makes it seem a little bit less scary, at least, because we have the Lord on our side. He's going to take care of us if we will but give those concerns to Him. All right, anybody else? Good thought. All right, so let's see if we can finish this first book. Before we do that, I want to look at this real quickly. I think this is a good way to look at the beginning of the book and the end. There's a lot of parallels. So the opening statement is concerning the writer, Peter himself. He ends this section with himself. I have written briefly in verse 12. He talks about those who are the elect at the beginning of the book, those who are elect, those who are in exile. And then he ends with she who is chosen, which is going to be related to the one who is in Babylon. But she is also elect. He talks about these exiles and their dispersion. He's going to talk about this one who is elect. She is at Babylon. In other words, she's also been dispersed in a sense. And then he begins with grace and peace, and that's how he ends the book. This is the true grace of God, peace to all of you. So there's a lot of connections between the beginning of the book and the ending of this book. So I just wanted to point that out because we're going to come back to that. I think that will help us maybe decide who this she who is chosen and who is at Babylon is. All right. So he mentions here in verse 12, by Silvanus, a faithful brother, as I regard him, I have written briefly to you, exhorting and declaring that this is the true grace of God. Stand firm in it. So first of all, and we talked about this, I think it was the first lesson, but Silvanus is mentioned here. And he's also mentioned in many other accounts in the New Testament, especially in some of Paul's letters. And that's the Latin form of the name. Sometimes he's referred to as Silas, a shortened word is Silas. And this would be most likely, I think, the Silas that Paul first meets at the Jerusalem conference in Acts chapter 15. And we're going to go back to Acts 15 a little bit to connect some dots with some other things he says here. But I just wanted to point that out, that he is mentioned there in Acts 15. I think this is the same Silas probably that he's referring to. And when does Saul, remember Saul becomes a partner with Paul. And when does he do that? Remember the circumstance that took place? I say Saul, I'm sorry, Silas. Silas and Paul. Thank you.
After him, Barnabas separated to go in a different direction.
That's right. So, Paul had a dispute with John Mark. And so, Barnabas ended up taking John Mark, and then Paul takes Silas, and they go on their separate ways, and they end up conquering more territory that way. But that's where Paul and Silas end up becoming travel partners. And Silvanus is also mentioned in 1st and 2nd Thessalonians. And so probably Silas, given the many times that Silas is mentioned in the book of Acts and in other parts of the Bible, that's my guess as to who this is. You know, it could be somebody else. We don't know for sure. It doesn't tell us more specifically who he is. But that's my guess as to who Peter is talking about. What people latch on to more is when it says that this was by Silvanus. By Silvanus. In turn, I think by, he's talking about this letter, so to speak. And when he says by him, there's a couple possibilities. It could be that he was the secretary, which is a very, it was very common in the ancient world for them whoever was writing the book would have a secretary who wrote for them. They called that an amanuensis. And similar to that, like in the book of Romans, Tertius is also mentioned there in the book of Romans as somebody who was a secretary. And so this is one possibility. My guess is that it could be that he was just a courier. So if you think back to Acts 15, where Silas first appears in the New Testament, remember the conference ends, and there's this letter that they're going to have sent out. In the middle to the end of Acts chapter 15. And in Acts chapter 15 and verse 22, the ESV puts it with the following letter. The New American Standard says it was this letter was sent by them. And if you have a New American Standard, it probably will have a footnote to describe what that literally means in the Greek, which is it's sent by their hand, literally by their hand. And so it's the same basic phraseology that Peter uses here when he says that this is by Silvanus. And so if you are sending a letter like this, like something that Peter is sending that's so personal, this is why you want someone who can be trusted. And Silvanus obviously would be that man for you. He was very trustworthy, somebody that Paul counted on. And so he's a faithful brother. And this would be a person that would totally be up for the job to deliver a message like this or a letter like this by hand. Then he says, declaring that this is the true grace of God. So what do you think the this is that he's referring to? This is the true grace of God. What is the true grace of God he's talking about here? Got him up there.
Well, the true grace of God is following Christ to God.
Okay. So Mr. Byers says that the grace of God is following Christ, which leads us to God. Okay? Yep. And part of the way that's done is through the gospel message, right? So it could be that he's specifically talking about the gospel message. It could be that he's talking about the way in God's provided for them, really encompasses all of this. He could be talking about this entire letter here. It could be the provision by the grace of God that he's talking about. And if you go through the letter of 1 Peter and you jot down the verses that use the word grace, or have the root word for grace or gracious, then you can look at them and look at them in the immediate context, and you'll spot quite a few things, like in chapter 5 and verse 5, and chapter 5 and verse 10, also talk about the grace of God. Peter does have a lot to say about God's grace in terms of his providing for his people. And so whatever the this may mean, what we can say is that everything Peter has written in this letter has been designed for a purpose. It's been designed to strengthen them by giving them the assurance that God is giving them all the gracious support that they need in order to endure what they're facing. And I think that's probably a good way to summarize what he's saying there when he's talking about the grace of God. Whatever this is, it encompasses everything that God has done through Jesus Christ that gives them, which is provided them, the support and strength they need to get through this suffering. Okay? Now for the harder part of this, verse 13, she who is at Babylon, who is likewise chosen, sends you greetings, and so does Mark, my son. So who's the she here? At least give some possibilities. Go ahead. Sorry. Yeah, Pat? Okay. Okay, so you have a... That's not fair, Pat. So she has a note in her Bible that says that this could be Rome. Okay? And we'll talk about that more in just a moment. Any other possibilities? Okay, it could be... a church that he's referring to. Maybe the church where he's from, where he's writing from. Okay? That's also a possibility. If you take a very literal interpretation, who could the she be? Some lady. It could be his wife. He was an elder. So it could be a reference to his wife or some lady. Some older commentaries actually will argue that that was Peter's wife he's referring to. I don't know how you can know that for sure. But I think that the first thing that we talked about, or the thing that Amanda mentioned, is probably what is the best interpretation, that this is probably referring to a church. And let me show you why I say that. He has already said that she who is at Babylon is what?
Chosen.
Is chosen. And if you go back to that first slide, I don't know how I did that. To that first slide, and you compare that to the very beginning of the book, you can see something that's very common, right? He's talking to Christians, wherever this church is. He's talking to them, and he calls them elect or chosen. And just like here at the end of the book, he says, she who is at Babylon is likewise chosen. This, whoever this is in Babylon, this she is chosen and elect just like you are. so that's the first thing that I would say to consider, that he's talking to those who are chosen Christians. So it seems to me that Peter is sending greetings from the community of believers who are also chosen, and where Peter may be, to the elect and chosen community that he's writing to. Okay, so they share something in common. He's already talked about brotherhood, that share things in common. You're not alone in your sufferings. The brotherhood elsewhere is also going through the same things. And so... it seems to me that it's possible that Peter is writing from where he is, those who were chosen, and he's sending this letter to another group of people who are also chosen. now, is this the other part about this? When he says Babylon, is this a literal or metaphorical Babylon that he's talking about? Yes. Good answer. So if you think literally about Babylon, the literal place Babylon does exist during this time period, or towards the end of Nero's reign. So it does exist, but it would probably be a little bit sketchy to try and find out exactly where this church would be at this particular point. It'd be hard to figure out, you know, at this time where they would have been located during the time Peter is writing this book. That would be something that would be difficult to try and find out. It's certainly possible that there are Christians there, but it's hard to know for certain. But because of this, and this is going to go to something that Pat just said, because of this, many people think that this is a code name. And it's a code name for the city of Rome. And so we certainly know this, that after the time of 1 Peter, Babylon becomes a code word, both in rabbinical writings and also in early Christian writings for the city of Rome. And so it's for that reason, and for some early Christian traditions that place Peter in the city of Rome. And this is actually even the place where tradition says that Peter became a martyr, was here in this very city called Rome. That being said, I do want us to keep this in mind, that wherever he is, why is it being called Babylon? Doesn't matter if it's literal or metaphorical, why is it called Babylon?
Babylon was a place of slavery.
All right, it's a place of slavery. It was a place that God's people were, where they were exiles. And that's been the key point in this book about the people he's writing to. All of us are in Babylon, right? We're all in Babylon. And we're all longing for Jerusalem. So, from that standpoint, it doesn't matter how you view Babylon here. If you look at it in the context of the book, this is a place of exile. And God's people are in exile. And they're longing for a better place. Then he says, "And she who is at Babylon, who is likewise chosen, sends you greetings, and so does Mark, my son." So, Mark, and we've mentioned this already at the beginning of this book. If you'll recall, back in the book of Acts, you had the maniacal king, Agrippa, who was going to have Peter put to death. And he's already put to death James, the son of Zebedee. He beheaded him. And he's going to do the same to Peter. Well, remember, Peter's in prison, and the Lord intervenes, and he delivers him. And where does Peter go? In Acts 12. Buddy. So in Acts chapter 12 and verse 12, when he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose other name was what? Was Mark. That's right. Where many were gathered together and were praying. And so the other name for John here is Mark. And it's just tradition. But it is the earliest historical tradition we have, so you have to give it some credence that this is the John Mark, that this is John Mark, and it's he that ended up accompanying Peter to Rome. And in fact, many early historical traditions believe that Peter, in fact, is the writer of what gospel? Anybody know? The Gospel of Mark. A lot of people think that Mark was Peter's memoirs. And so, that's just tradition, but a lot of people think that, and there's probably some truth to that. And so, that's partly because the book is closely associated with Peter as well. I would say that as well. All right, so he ends here with, "Greet one another with the kiss of love. Peace to all who are in Christ." And so in Paul's letter, remember, he does something very similar. He describes the kiss as a holy kiss. And given the fact that these are Christians under duress and being slandered, why might this be an appropriate phrase to end with? Peace to all of you. They having a lot of peace? No. They're being slandered. They're being reviled. And so, what better way for Peter to end a book than to remind them, you may not be having the peace that you hope to have here on earth, but in terms of being in Christ, that's where your peace is found. And so take comfort in that. All right, any questions or comments on that? We got through the book. I can't believe it. Say that again. Okay, 2 John. Talks about. Yeah, so there's going to be some. 2 John does talk about a lady as well. Again, I tend to think he's probably talking about a church here, just because of the context of the book of Peter. When you look at the beginning, and we will be going through that in the third quarter, the first, second, and third John. So we'll get to that when we get there. But yeah, thank you, Pat. Anything else?
And so Peter could reflect on the way that Jesus left them in the time of turmoil.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Mr. Byers just made the point that Jesus also talks about this at the end of the supper, right? And he leaves them with the same phraseology that Peter leaves them with at the end of the book. Peace, may peace go with you. Yeah, that's a very good thought. Very good thought. Anything else? All right. So we're not going to really be able to get into this tonight, but between now and Sunday, go ahead and be looking at chapter 1 and of 2 Peter. I've already done the calculations, and we're not going to get through the book. That meeting's throwing me off. I was going to get through the book if it weren't for that, I'm sure. But think about one thing I wanted to spend some time on Sunday morning is I want to think about the authenticity of the book of 2 Peter. How many of you have ever heard that this was not written by Peter? Anybody heard that before? Okay, I know at least a couple of you. All right, so I want to tackle that. And the reason I want to tackle that is because sometimes, you know, when we get into a setting like this, all of us, most of us being Christians, sometimes we kind of overlook some of the things that some of the skeptics will say about a book like 2 Peter. But I do think it's important to look at what the skeptics say in terms of the author, whether Peter really wrote this book or not, look at their arguments for this, and then also look at some ways that we can rebut that. Because it's good for us to know how to think and to think the way they think, and also to look logically at some reasonings for fighting that, their arguments. And one of the reasons is because, and I did this too. And you, some of you, when you all went off to college, you get off to college and people, skeptics of the Bible, will throw things at you, and it can leave you in fear. And you go back home and you're thinking, wow, I hadn't thought about that before. And it can be very scary. And so it's important, I think, sometimes to look at some of the things that skeptics have to say and then look at some ways in which we can defend the authenticity of the Bible, the authenticity of some of the books, especially in the New Testament. And so we're going to do that on Sunday. We don't have time to get into it. I think, did the second bell already ring? No, it hasn't yet? Okay, well, we're going to end there anyway. But think about that. See if you can find some reading that you can do on that. And be ready to talk about that. And then we'll get into the text. Shouldn't take us too awfully long to talk about the authenticity of 2 Peter. All right, thank you.